Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Chris Hedges is our guest this hour, the war reporter and doomsayer, with a solemn sermon of warning about the trouble we are all in. His new book is titled America, The Farewell Tour. Donald Trump has a minor part in it. We're in the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. Oddly enough, Chris and I are in the same seats, same stage, that I shared a few months ago with the upbeat psychologist Steven Pinker around his book, Enlightenment Now, sequel to Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature. Chris Hedges is drawn to bad news the way Steve Pinker is drawn to the good. Chris Hedges got hooked on war assignments with the New York Times, hardened on battlefields in Latin America, Africa, the Balkans, and the Middle East. He got some of his soul back studying theology and classical literature for his bestseller, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. The Rush of Battle, he has written, going back to ancient times in Homer and the Bible, is an often lethal addiction. It's a drug he himself ingested for years. But it's just one of the addictions that Chris Hedges sees in our country and our culture today. His new book begins with a preface from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran priest and theologian who was executed by the Nazis in 1945 for his part in the anti-Hitler resistance. The nothingness into which the West is sliding, Hedges quotes Bonhoeffer's last manuscript, is not a natural end, not the death or sinking of a community. It is a nothingness that is rebellious, violent, anti-God, and anti-human, the utmost manifestation of all the forces opposed to God. I asked Chris Hedges at the outset to locate his idea of that nothingness in our world today.
That's a culture which we've created, a commercial culture, which orchestrates alienation, loneliness, unhappiness, a sense of inadequacy, and promises us that if we invest in that culture, both financially and personally, which is a culture that at its core is about the cult of the self, we can find the happiness that they have destroyed. But of course, as Proust understood, every time we buy their experience, whether just commercially or emotionally, or their product, it is only the starting point for new desires. And what, in biblical terms, it is a culture of idolatry. And the writers of the Bible understood that idols demand, in the beginning, the sacrifice of others, but in the end, like Moloch, they always demand your sacrifice. You are sacrificed on that altar. And I think that spiritual malaise, that cult of the self, has created tremendous depression and unhappiness, which is fed by this never-ending cycle. I mean, what is Facebook or Instagram or any of these other social media platforms? They're many forms of the self-presentation that obsesses a figure like Trump. It's what Neil Gabler called Life, the movie. And, you know, we all have our own versions of it. It's about posturing. It's not about truth, and it's certainly the opposite of friendship. Friendship, and most of us, if we're honest, will acknowledge that we probably only have two or three real friends, and some of us have none. Friendship is about a relationship where that person loves you enough to tell you the unpleasant truths about yourself you don't want to hear because they care. Friendship is about a relationship that ultimately is perhaps even beyond articulation, as is faith and the transcendent. I quote a lot of writers on theology, Tillich and others, because I think, like Kierkegaard, that there is a deep, deep spiritual sickness within the society, and that we have created powerful mechanisms to prey upon and to exacerbate that sickness. I mean, Tolstoy got it right. The only true happiness is to live for others, as any parent instinctively knows. I just taught Victor Hugo's Les Miserables in a prison.
Oh, what a book.
That is the nothingness. The evil of this society is to make us hollow men and women, to quote Eliot.
We get from the sublime to the ridiculous, which is to say the Trump moment, but in a short form, Chris, what defines this moment of collapse in your view? I mean, Tolstoy felt it more than 100 years ago.
Dostoevsky.
Walker Percy wrote brilliantly about it 40, 50 years ago. What about this moment?
So the social bonds are broken. The primacy of profit has destroyed the economic base of the country, which was industry with deindustrialization. The power of corporations has taken from us the ability to protect ourselves and promote our own interests, whether that's labor unions, whether that's a press that actually writes about and reflects the concerns of the majority of the American people. I mean, CNN is as culpable for the burlesque as Trump, and they make money on it. They made more money last year than they've ever made. But it's all court gossip. It's not news.
No, it's utterly incredible. 3 years from November 2015, this country, the public conversation, has been nothing but Donald J. Trump. You couldn't have imagined it. But he's symptomatic of populist speech, McCarthyism, grand looks consumerism, gross sexism in person and in cultural monuments like pro wrestling. He's a product of 60 years of television, an advertising culture, and a propaganda culture on crack. I mean, he is feeding on the disgust with this world that we have made for ourselves.
So this is just like Yugoslavia, which I covered for the New York Times. You have an ineffectual liberal elite that is unwilling or unable to deal with the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia. And so, of course, there what triggered it was hyperinflation. And you vomited up these bizarre, buffoonish, insane figures, Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman. Go back to Weimar. Mm-hmm. What happens in Weimar? The liberals, the social democrats, and Ebert are in charge. The Nazis are polling in the single digits in 1928. You have the 1929 crash. Ebert and the social democrats, instead of responding to the distress of the German people, seek to placate the international banking system and impose draconian forms of austerity, including abolishing unemployment insurance. And there's a line in Klemperer, Victor Klemperer, who writes his diaries, I Shall Bear Witness, where after the Reichstag fire, the social democrats are terrified that the Nazis are going to lock them up and they all flee to Switzerland. And which I didn't know until I read the diaries, he was in Leipzig, 100,000 people were in the streets protesting martial law. But the social democrats... And he said the sentiment was, at least the Nazis have the courage of their convictions. Hmm. I think we underestimate the legitimate rage on the part of a working class that was deeply betrayed, in particular by Bill Clinton. Yep. And that the rage is worse towards the Democrats because they pretended that they were watching out for their interests. So as you know, I was in Anderson, Indiana, the old GM.
Yep.
25,000 union jobs, they were making $25, $30 an hour, they had pensions, they had medical benefits, they had a strong union. Clinton passes NAFTA, and GM, they didn't just close the plants, they bulldozed them. So they're huge, grass, weed-choked expanses where these plants... I mean, the old UAW workers, who spent 30 years, they can't even drive... They will bypass those streets so they don't have to look at it.
Mm.
And those jobs went to Monterrey, Mexico, where Mexican workers are making $3 an hour without benefits. They voted for Bernie Sanders, but they weren't going to vote for Clinton. The power of Trump is... And this was also true in Yugoslavia, and it was also true in Weimar. Because remember, a figure like... In particular, Göring was quite witty and funny. Hmm. Göring was quite funny, actually. And like Trump, ridiculed these elites, like the Jeb Bushes.
Mm.
And what's happened is that the ruling ideology, so in this case, neoliberalism, is a utopian, as John Ralston Saul says, a utopian ideology. The whole idea that any society throughout history has decided that every aspect of that society should be ruled by the dictates of the marketplace is insane. But this ideology, and every promise, of course, of neoliberalism, which Thomas Friedman popularizes in his columns, has turned out to be wrong. You know, that it'll build a larger middle class, that it will spread democracy around the globe. I mean, he was even writing there was going to end wars, and remember the famous line that... So the collapse of the ideology is crucial because, and this is across the political spectrum, no one's buying it. And so they are using much more draconian forms of control. That's the security and surveillance state, which Snowden exposed and which our leaders, including Obama, did nothing to reverse. And it has created such a revulsion towards the elites, Republican and Democratic, that when a figure like Trump comes along, it is kind of darkly cathartic. I would also add just one more thing about the white working class. So when Durkheim writes on suicide, he said, usually the lowest rates of suicide are among the poor.
Hmm.
The poor and soldiers.
Hmm.
I mean, he talks about different forms of suicide and soldiers can sacrifice themselves. But the poor, because they realize that the rules are fixed against them, and Baldwin writes the same point. He said, when he talks about why African-American men tend not to have a midlife crisis, because they, African-Americans, understand that there are two sets of rules. But the white working class, which at a certain period, especially after World War II, achieved an economic prosperity that was kind of remarkable, believe the myth. And with the understanding that they've been had, I think express a very frightening and violent rage, which manifests itself in mass shootings, hate groups, and supporting a figure like Trump.
We're getting the reporter Chris Hedges' farewell tour of the symptoms of a society on the spot. And he's barely begun on the sorrows of empire and war. This is Open Source. Chris Hedges, our guest, is a preacher's kid who grew up in Maine, went to Colgate, made a name for himself covering wars all over the world for the New York Times. Then he took up theology and big books as a sort of sideline and reached a personal, professional breaking point, resisting the Iraq War from inside his famous newspaper at the cost of his job. He's our guest at the Cambridge Forum in the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. His new book is America, The Farewell Tour. You're leaving one huge zone, my favorite zone, out, which is George Bush and the Iraq War. To my mind, the Leiden line is that that is pretty much the bone in our, it's worse than a bone in the throat. It set the stage for where we're at. An illegal, immoral, irrational $5 trillion or maybe a lot more war that goes on today, in which the United States chose war, chose torture, ignited terrorism, embodied terrorism, literally killed a country in front of our eyes, corrupted the democratic opposition, including our friend John Kerry, and destroyed the media. I mean, the war began and went to its end with the cheerleading of those institutions, including your friend Tom Friedman, William Sapphire, David Brooks, and they're still working. I mean, anyway, the point is only that to see Trump, he is symptomatic of all that betrayal of the working class. At the same time, he's the most, I want to say, viable person who ever tipped the tables on Jeb Bush and then on the Clintons. I don't want to give him any credit for it exactly, but here's the question for my friend Chris Hedges. Do you find your heart really rooting for the wreckers, the Trumpers, so to speak, or you certainly don't root for the establishment. Where's your heart, Chris Hedges?
My heart is with, at this point, the 60 or 70% of Americans who are being pushed towards a modern form of serfdom in the oligarchic system. And you bring up the war. So, and as you know, I had a very contentious relationship with the New York Times. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, was denouncing the war. I was booed off of a commencement stage. And, of course, I actually knew the Middle East and knew the instrument of war, unlike Pinker. And I was given a formal written reprimand and told I was no longer allowed to speak publicly about criticizing the war, and I left the paper over that issue. So when you talk about all those people who were wrong being still in power, but that's a misreading, because they may have been wrong, but they played their role. And the role of, this is Chomsky, the role of the liberal elites is to discredit. And you can read the review of this book in the New York Times and the Washington Post, because that's exactly what they do. To discredit the critics on the left, because they set the moral parameters. And they are essentially given their place in a capitalist democracy because they make sure nobody crosses those parameters. Nobody actually questions the system of capitalism. Nobody questions the intentions of going into Iraq. They may concede afterwards that it didn't go quite as it should. So they played their role perfectly, which is why they're still there. That's their role. No, we can't talk about leaders. I mean, this is a complete misreading of what's happened in this country. It's far more serious than that. And I think one of the things that informed this book was the 2 years I spent writing a book on the Christian right. Because the Christian right is really the antecedent. But before that, let me just respond one more thing on the war. So in and you know from the book, and this is from McCoy, but late empire, and McCoy, the historian McCoy, who wrote a very good book called Shadows in the American Century, which I would recommend, he writes that empires at their beginning actually use military force very carefully and very judiciously. Empires at the end, in decline, engage in catastrophic military adventurism that fuels the decline in an attempt to restore a lost greatness. So you look at, for instance, the end of the Athenian Empire. They invade Sicily. The entire Athenian fleet is sunk. Most of the soldiers are killed. The empire's over. You look at the Suez Crisis. The British Empire is in decline from the end of World War I till 1956. Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal. The British invade with the French and have to retreat in humiliation. The pound sterling is dropped as the world's reserves currency, and the British economy goes into a tailspin. That's the death. McCoy actually gives it a date, which I would never do, 2030. But so we have 17 years of warfare. There's a front page story about the debt. Did you read those?
I'll read the Times tonight.
I just read that. What may soon exceed the cost of the U.S. military? Interest on U.S. debt. Within a decade, more than $900 billion in interest payments will be due annually. This is what happens at the end of empire. You extend yourself militarily beyond your ability to sustain it financially, and the cost in order to carry out this military adventurism, this is Thucydides, is to just hollow out the country from the inside. So Thucydides writes that the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. Why? Because the military adventurism is so costly. Your roads are not maintained. Your public libraries or school. The crown jewel of American democracy is our public school system. And we are watching it be destroyed. And so as you hollow the country out from the inside, you use the harsher forms of control, which I've spent 20 years reporting on the outer reaches of empire. Militarized police, suspension of civil liberties, wholesale surveillance, revoking basic rights like due process, militarized drones. It's all coming to a town near you. And And that's how empires go down. So yes, the military adventurism is important, but it's just a piece. And we've got to stop personalizing this issue around Trump. We've got to stop thinking that the Democratic parties are going to cough up some magic candidate. And the Christian right, my study of the Christian right was called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War in America. I was trying to reach out to them. And Bill Moyers did not want me to use the word fascist. And I actually, when I finished the 2 years of reporting, I sat down with Robert Paxton, who wrote Anatomy of Fascism, and Fritz Stern, who wrote The Politics of Cultural Despair and left Germany as an 18-year-old, two of our greatest scholars on fascism, and I was with them for several hours, and I just threw everything I had found, and I wanted them to be able to argue me out of using that word. And at least to my mind, they could not.
Tell me what's wrong with this sort of idiot definition of fascism. Fascism, the fascis, the binding of sheaves, it stands for the unification of war-making power, police power, opinion-making power, the electoral machinery, churches, media, the whole thing in one. To my mind, God knows what's ahead, but this is why I go back to the Iraq War. That was all of those institutions bound together unanimously. That was pretty bad. And still...
Yeah, but Chris, it was different. So as bad as it was. And we can't divorce the war from the reconfiguration of the society into a corporate oligarchy. We have the largest social inequality in American history, worse than the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
And so the war is part of a peace. I mean, why are we still at war in Afghanistan? The Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than when we went in 17 years ago. Why? Because Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Halliburton, they're making a fortune. It's propelled forward by the primacy of profit at the expense of everything else. Why are we expanding NATO? Which doesn't make any sense. Why are we expanding NATO to the Ukraine? Well, because, and let's not forget that Reagan had promised Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the German borders after the unification of Germany. Why? Because it's a $1 billion industry. I was just in Poland. I got off the airport. There's a giant billboard from Raytheon. Because if you have to reconfigure the old Soviet bloc military machine to make it compatible with NATO. So over and over and over, it is about the primacy of profit over what's rational. And we haven't even spoken about climate change. These people are driving us closer and closer, and we're pretty close, to the extinction of the human species because of the mania for profit. And this is Polanyi, I mean, The Great Transformation, which is his book on unregulated capitalism. Let me just, on the Christian right. So I'm inside the Christian right, and however bad Bush was, and they were all bad, and I would not say that they had totalitarian characteristics. They may have had authoritarian characteristics. What we're seeing now is much worse. And in the Christian right, I interviewed dozens and dozens of people who came out of lives of real desperation, who were followers in these mega churches. And I spent a lot of time in the churches, and I was at a pro-life weekend, and their despair was real. The divorces, the sexual abuse, the domestic abuse, the struggle with addictions, the evictions, the underemployment, the jail time, their lives in the real world. And you went to their small towns in Ohio, and it does look like everything's boarded up, and the only nice building is the megachurch. And they couldn't cope with the real world. And so they did what anthropologists call it crisis cults. They fled into a world of magic Jesus.
Hmm.
And in that world, like the world we're in now, reality and verifiable fact just does not intrude on your world vision because verifiable fact and reality, I mean, like, you know, on the, let's say, the issue of creationism, you can't argue them out of it because they're terrified of being pushed back into the world that almost destroyed them. And so the nucleus of the totalitarian system that is headed our way, especially as we barrel towards another financial collapse, is magical thinking, the permanent lie. I mean, so Bush lies about weapons of mass destruction. Clinton lies about NAFTA. But Bush does not claim that Iraq still has weapons of mass destruction. Clinton does not claim that NAFTA created millions of wonderful middle-class jobs. But with Trump, like the Christian right, verifiable fact and reality no longer matter. You have the photographic evidence in front of you. And Hannah Arendt writes about this. And she said that in any totalitarian system where the permanent lie replaces any discussion based on verifiable fact, it creates a collective schizophrenia. I'm sure we all feel it.
I noticed on Facebook this morning, well, actually, a very good friend of mine, young man, mid-30s, African-American from Trinidad originally, he served 5 to 7 year sentence for a complete non-crime. He's a perfect model of young black men who go to prison in a system of mass incarceration. But he wrote in his Facebook page this morning, I mean, he knows more about injustice in America than you and I will ever experience. He said, there should be a line between negative, miserable people and positive people, and the negative shall stew in their mess until they realize that most of their pain is self-inflicted. He's talking about us, among others, but sort of what's wrong with you people and what's right about him, and I'm still trying to dope it out. What is the type of human being, including you, and in, you're the, just a more vehement version of me, that is so compelled, and rightly, I think, to dwell in this gathering darkness?
Because it's real. Climate reports alone should terrify the hell out of us. I mean,
and of course.
And I covered war for 20 years. I didn't use, none of us who survived, use the word optimist or pessimist. You made a very cold calculation of what the weapons systems were down there, and then you responded. And I actually look at that Facebook message as a kind of cri de coeur from somebody who's thrown into the criminal caste and is trusting in the power of positive thinking, which is fed to us across the cultural and political spectrum. It's Oprah. It's positive psychologists. It's, you know, our modern version of Candide, Pinker. It's Hollywood. It's the Christian right. And it's reality is not an impediment to you, what you desire. But what that does is essentially erase reality. And I was with Cornel West this morning, who I love, and then we were 4 hours together, and then he dragged me off to his Kierkegaard class. coming out of a religious tradition, to go back to where you were, which I do, is to have a tragic view of human nature and human society. And in fact, that's the best protection. It's not happy thoughts. It's not positive thinking. That, in fact, sets you up for despair. I mean, for 20 years, and you know, without being melodramatic, a lot of the people I worked with were killed. My closest friend was killed. I worked with for 10 years, Kurt Short.
Killed where, Chris?
He was killed in Sierra Leone, but we covered the war in Iraq. We covered the war in Sarajevo and Kosovo. Okay. He was killed with another friend of mine. But I mean, I lost many of the people I worked with. And so what was the primary aspect of our job? It was true in El Salvador. It was true in Bosnia. The Serbs would go into a village. They would kill a bunch of people, and then they would close the roads to try and keep the journalists out. And we would have to put our satellite phones in our backpacks and walk in, often many miles, to report on this slaughter. And we knew that we were going to wake up tomorrow and they were doing it somewhere else. And, you know, they were often had snipers shooting at us. It was very dangerous. Maybe it was Pyrrhic, but that ability to document those crimes and recognize the destruction of those lives was enough. We didn't think that we were going to stop it. And that's why, as you correctly pointed out, it becomes in the act of resistance that you find freedom. And not even freedom, more than freedom. You find euphoria. It's not a battle between good and evil. It's a battle between a great evil trying to crush human kindness. But if human kindness has not been crushed, even now, then evil will never win. And if you come at the world like that, instead of the way the consumer society wants you to come at the world, then you are protected emotionally to continue acts of resistance and evil, and realizing that, as Daniel Berrigan once told me, I asked Daniel Berrigan, how do you define faith? He said, it's the belief that the good draws to it the good. Even if empirically everything around you says otherwise. That's what faith is. The Buddhists call it karma. But you know what? It's true. The good does draw to it the good.
I think it's fascinating that we, and you especially, keep coming back to religious insight. I'm thinking of St. Paul, letter to the Romans. We rejoice also in tribulation.
Of course.
Out of tribulation comes experience. Out of experience, patience. Out of patience, hope. Chris, I've never heard you better. But let's put it to your wonderful audience and give them a voice too. Coming up, Chris Hedges redefines and revalues the ancient words faith, hope, and human kindness for this time. This is Open Source. We're in an old-fashioned citizen forum in what happens to be a church hall in Harvard Square. Chris Hedges is our guest this hour, and his audience is about to get into the act.
So my question is regarding the global kind of presence of the American empire. So as empire retreats, what does it mean for the rest of the world? Plus, I think, what can the especially developing nations can do about it?
Right. What happens is the moment the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, because it has an artificial value, in essence, because of that, the moment that it is dropped, then the empire has to contract because we can't pay for it. Nobody wants to buy treasury bonds. The value of the dollar drops. Imports become extremely expensive. And what I worry, and you know, I would add the fact that our financial system is once again being grossly mismanaged by Citibank and Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo and everyone else. What they've done since the 2008 crash is been handed by the Fed out of electronic ether, according to the University of Missouri, their estimate, $26 trillion. Trillion. And what have they done with it? They haven't, as China did, rebuild the infrastructure, create jobs, invest in the real economy. They have taken that money and used it to buy back their own stock. That's why the whole idea of the overheated stock market is a sign of economic health is nuts. They've hoarded it, or they've gambled with it. So the Times had a story, I guess, a couple weeks ago about the next dot-com bubble being the fracking industry, because like the dot-com industry, the fracking industry is based on projected profits, not actual. Fracking, in fact, is a huge money loser. The $280 billion have been invested in fracking. So the money was given to them at virtually 0% interest, but it has to be repaid. So what have they done? They've gone to the beleaguered population and imposed harsher and harsher forms of debt peonage. It's why even if you have medical insurance, you're getting all these new costs and copays, and it's why we have $1.5 trillion in student debt. It's why we have $13 trillion in personal household debt, and it's why cities, and I opened the book in Scranton, are facing insolvency, and so I opened the book there where they're selling off municipal assets. Their pension funds have dropped 40% because of the crash of 2008. And so they're selling off their sewer system, their parking authority, their utilities in a desperate effort to stay solvent, but then they don't have anything left to sell. So my fear is that the system, the malaise, the anomie is so widespread. The pathologies of self-destruction, including suicide, are an epidemic. But we live in a period of relative stability. But with a financial crash, which is coming. It's going to come, I don't know when, but it's coming. And with the dropping of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, that financial crisis and all of totalitarian movements rise to full fruition out of a crisis. Because our movements have been destroyed, our press has been corroded, our democratic institutions don't work, then I worry that the monsters will really come out.
Thank you.
I want to go deeper into sort of the last points you were making. I'm from Detroit, and you know, you hear all the statistics coming out of there. I'm from an area where 9 out of 10 young black men end up in prison, and I was the one who didn't, right? And so I went to college, went to the University of Michigan, started a company. And so as I've been successful in some of my endeavors, I've noticed that I'm often the only young black guy in the room, especially from a neighborhood like mine. I feel like in some ways, often in the social justice spaces, we frame the system as if it's more powerful than the people. I'm one of those people who's always telling the kids, you know, you can come, you know, through your circumstances. So I'm trying to put the power into the people and their potential and not necessarily in the system. But I would just say for sort of marginalized communities, not necessarily specifically.
So the problem in marginalized communities is a structural problem. And as they carried out the kind of corporate coup d'etat, which really began in earnest under Thatcher and Reagan, they changed the whole paradigm. Sturt Hall writes about this. You didn't look to government anymore. It's that famous Reagan line, you know, government is not the solution, it's part of the problem. And as Sturt Hall writes quite astutely, they told the beleaguered white working class that there was an assault on their national identity. And the Clintons rose to power on this. People forget. But Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition was dismantled by the Clintons, who were using coded racist language and wanted to out law and order the Republicans. Biden was a big factor in this. So it was actually the Democrats that accelerated mass incarceration from about 700,000 under Clinton to, by the time he was out, 2 million. Now, half of the people in our prison system were never charged with physically harming another person. The other thing Clinton did, they destroyed the courts. 94% of the people in prison never had a jury trial, and the students I teach with the longest sentences are the ones who went to trial. Unfortunately, they trusted the system, but the system makes an example of them because, as Michelle Alexander points out, if everyone went to trial, the system would crash. It's built on plea deals. So one of the things that always breaks my heart in the prison is, and it's one of the reasons I teach in the prison, is that the structural racism, which is so pronounced, as to make it, as you know from Detroit, almost impossible to make a living in the legal economy, has effectively sold a lot of these people this idea that it's your fault, you made mistakes. You know, August Wilson had a great line. He said, all the great black warriors in this country are in jail because when the society denied them the ability to get what they needed for their family, they just found another way to get it. And I think that there's a conscious effort on the part of the corporate state to deny, they always talk about STEM, you know, it's all vocational, to deny what I would call an education to the oppressed, to hide the fact that these structures of power are designed to destroy their lives. You know from Detroit, you lock up the men and you evict the women and children. And that's what happens. And why? Because if you are evicted, on the average, it's every 6 months in a poor community, you finally, the third or fourth time you're evicted, you don't talk to your neighbors because you know you're going to be evicted. It's why they make it so unpleasant when you visit a prison. And the children are terrorized. I mean, there's no other word for it. And people stand out in the rain for hours without bathroom facilities because they're terrified of any unity. The most astute political class in America are African Americans. They are the one class that tends to actually understand what their interests are, which is why they're all being erased from the voter rolls, including by the Democratic Party. So my feeling is, and this comes out of Rosa Luxemburg, who I like very much, Lenin's only intellectual equal, and which Lenin would admit, she was right where Lenin was wrong. Luxemburg would say, yes, you have to do what you do. We have to address hunger. We have to address despair. But at the same time, we have to educate. And so I would say, yes, what you're doing is fantastic and important, but at the same time, consciousness, 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 and, you know, there's nobody better to start with than Malcolm.
Hi. When I was in grammar school, we went through drills for what we would do if there was a nuclear holocaust. And some of us in the room probably remember, we used to joke about it and say, you sit down and you put your head between your knees and you kiss your ass goodbye. And there is a certain aspect of all of this that makes me remember that. What would you suggest is already happening now or that we could start that you personally find promising in addition to overthrowing corporations?
Well, I write about it at the end. The last chapter is called Freedom. And I was at Standing Rock. I actually gave a talk in Boston a couple years ago, and all of the activists, because there's a pipeline running through Boston, and they said, you know, we've gone to our elected officials, we've done petitions. I said, no, what you have to do is go out and buy junk cars, and when the construction equipment comes in to build the pipeline, you've got to drive all the junk cars to block everything and take the batteries out and walk away. That's the kind of stuff we got to do. It's the activists who got on the railroad tracks in the Northwest to stop the bitumen tar sands fuel. That's what we got to do. And they will be vicious, as they were in Standing Rock. I mean, Standing Rock was an important event for me because it had the spiritual element that Chris is bringing out that I think is key. And it's what Reinhold Niebuhr calls sublime madness. Sublime madness of the soul. We have to stop asking ourselves if we will succeed. We have to enter into the realm of faith that what we're doing is right. This society is wonderful about, you know, eternal youth. But we have very short lifespans on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old. And it is that Auden line, the ironic point of light that flashes out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, compose like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, despair, show an affirming flame. Read Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago, and don't get the abridged. The last volume is on resistance. Resistance in the gulags. Do they succeed? I mean, they're crushed. And yet, it is that power of an invisible witness. I mean, as Chris knows, the greatest force that drives me is my father, who was a Presbyterian minister, who was a sergeant in North Africa in World War II and joined the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement, for which the Presbyterian Church pushed him out. He'd been a parish minister for 40 years. He was a great preacher. And the church said, that's it. You're not allowed to speak publicly the same thing the New York Times did to me about gay rights. His brother was gay. He was very close to my uncle. And so what did my dad do? He had a church in Syracuse. I was at Colgate as an undergrad. His answer to them was to hold an Easter service for the GBLT community of the city of Syracuse. And he came down and got me. And he said, this is probably the last time you'll ever hear me preach. And he got up and he said, marriage is a sacrament. It's not a reward for being a heterosexual. And any church that doesn't honor the sacrament of marriage does not deserve to call itself Christian. When the New York Times called me in and said that I was no longer allowed to speak publicly about the Iraq war because I was, quote unquote, impugning the impartiality of the New York Times. And I'm not going to pretend that was easy, to lose my job and my pension. But I knew as I sat there that I had a choice. And that choice was this. I could pay fealty to my career and muzzle myself. but to do so would be to betray my father. And I walked out of 229 West 43rd Street, and I realized for the first time what my father had given me, and that was freedom. I didn't need the New York Times to tell me who I was. I knew I would never be rewarded for virtue. I knew the very institution that I invested my life in, as he had, would ultimately turn me away. And I often say, it's my voice you hear, but it's my father's words. And in the Christian faith, we call that resurrection.
Amen. Amen. Thank you. Maybe one more question?
Yeah, I'd like to know, do you think history is irreversible if we could bring FDR back from the grave and the New Deal and have two parties instead of a party of people and property again, instead of two parties of property, that this might be the beginning of turning things around?
This time in history is different because human civilization, let's put that in quotes, has existed for 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age, which is a tiny portion of time on the planet Earth. And it's existed because of peculiar changes to the biosphere, including the Gulf Stream, which, you know, didn't exist before. That is called the Holocene. We have now moved into the Anthropocene, where we are destroying the biosphere that made this 10,000-year process possible. And that was accelerated by the rise of technology and industry. So we can't go back to where we are. And that's why you have so many theories about why we have never found intelligent, quote-unquote, intelligent life in the universe, because in order to achieve the level that we've achieved, it requires such an amount of energy that you end up destroying the biosphere that makes the peculiar conditions, this tiny window that made our rise possible. And the reason climate scientists are so terrified of going beyond 2 degrees Celsius is because of feedback loops. And they know what feedback loops are because they've studied them on Venus, which used to have water and is now 800 degrees. That your whole system begins to destroy itself because of a series of acidification in the ocean, rising temperatures, once the polar ice caps are gone. So we can't go back to where we are. We have to respond creatively and rationally to a new system, to create a new system. And this gets into the question of human progress, which I think is a myth. So what I fear is that, you know, we talked earlier about the power of positive thinking. I don't share this culture's mania for hope. I think it's very dangerous. And I think the hardest thing before us is to face what's before us, honestly, and because it isn't pleasant. It's scary. I got kids. I'm terrified. I mean, my youngest son's favorite book is called Out of the Blue. It's about narwhals. And I'm thinking, probably if things do not change within your lifetime, every single one of those sea creatures will be extinct. That's the world we're facing. And we're not responding. And we're not responding because the people who have total control are blinded by a mania for profit, by idols, by the cult of the self. And it's not just Trump. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris Hedges. This crowd got more out of you, Chris, than Bill Moyers ever did. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Chris Hedges' new book is called America, The Farewell Tour. Our conversation with Chris was recorded at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square, courtesy of the Cambridge Forum. Check our website, radioopensource.org, for lots more conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletter. Subscribe to our podcast. still the first and longest running podcast on Earth. And think of leaving a donation for the hardest working team in radio. Open Source relies on the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies and Rebecca Panutka. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.